We're talking today with Tom Mateer, who's one of the leading personal injury attorneys here in Colorado and a particular expert on dealing with cases that involve brain injury. Mr. Mateer, about what proportion of your cases that involve brain injury come from motor vehicle accidents?
I would say that in general, about 75% of our brain injury cases come from either automobile, motorcycle, or trucking accidents in which our clients have been injured. As you know, brain injury tends to happen when there are accelerations involved. Motor vehicles and motorcycles are, unfortunately, those accidents are prevalent, and a lot of families get their lives disrupted because of brain injury as a result.
And are there other common causes that you see in your practice? Like, we're here in Colorado, about ski and snowboarding accidents, or mountain biking, or...
We do see ski and snowboard collisions in which individuals are brain injured and end up in a law firm as a result. Most important for health, as you know, individuals need to wear helmets when they're skiing or snowboarding. It's just a dangerous thing to do, to take a fall and not have your head protected. We have a lot of clients who get in bicycle accidents and sustain a traumatic brain injury as a result, as well as people in the oil fields, in mining accidents, farm equipment accidents, just a variety of ways that people end up with brain injuries, even such things as slipping and falling downstairs. Our practice reflects the population of brain-injured individuals, and we would just find in our society that about 75% of those come from automobile or trucking or motorcycle accidents. Now, there are sports injuries, which also we end up advising and helping families with. However, those usually aren't in the litigation situation, although occasionally they can be. You're aware, I know, of second impact syndrome.
Yes.
And what we see with football players in the high schools and colleges who are returned, and even professional football, who are returned to activity too soon. We also have seen that on the soccer field, the lacrosse field. One of the challenges is for our football and other sport coaches to learn about when a student or a player can be returned to play. We're fortunate here in Colorado that Dr. James Kelly is one of the leading neurologists and neuroscientists on that very topic, and we're hoping to soon have a workshop for coaches in the state with Dr. Kelly in attendance to help teach when return to work or return to play should occur.
So how long have you been practicing as a plaintiff's attorney, and how did your interest in brain injury cases develop?
Well, I've been a plaintiff's attorney for over 29 years now, and I was fortunate in that I started out actually defending insurance companies, and so I got a look at what they do, how they think, and what the cynic's side is all about. It didn't take me very long at all to realize that I needed to be representing the person that was hurt rather than the corporate interest that wanted to keep money and not protect that person. And early on in my career, I met a young woman who had been in a car accident, and she hit her head on the steering wheel, and she had a seizure right there at the scene. And it was life-altering for her. But because of the seizure, I recognized that there was a brain injury immediately when I first met her and her wonderful family. She was a young woman who had a brilliant future, and this brain injury was actually what we would think of in those classifications as a mild traumatic brain injury that was complex. Because, of course, we had the seizure. But the seizure, you know, it opened a door for me because I began to then really study brain injury, and that's when I first realized that I may have in my career, even earlier, represented some individuals who had suffered brain injury because I knew they had lost consciousness, that there were some personality changes. But I made the mistake of thinking that those personality changes were just because of stress they were under, or maybe they were always like that because I didn't know them before they'd been hurt. In the case, I'm going to call this young lady Molly. In Molly's case, I hadn't known her before either. But because of the seizure, I began to ask questions of her family members, and they started telling me how her temper had gotten short and how she didn't seem to remember things that were being told to her. and her mother was getting frustrated, and her boyfriend was beginning to think that maybe she wasn't the person for him after all, even though they were engaged and expecting to get married. And so it opened my eyes to begin to ask questions, and then I got to her neurologist, and I asked about seizures and whether seizures could change personality. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, Tom, there's something else going on here. You've got a seizure, but she has a traumatic brain injury that's got symptoms and other causes than just the seizure that we've seen." And so he started to recommend that I do some reading and that I go talk to psychologists. And then I thought, well, let's get her to a neuropsychologist. And so I called the neurologist and said, "Is it something we should do?" And he said, "Yes. We should wait another month or two before we do that to let the brain heal for a while." But at 6 months, there was a neuropsychological examination done, and sure enough, here was a change, a significant change in a woman who had just graduated with honors from Colorado State University. And she wasn't able to do those things. And I began to go and spend significant amounts of time with her, and I could see that her temper seemed to not match what her friends had described, and she told me that she was scared and she didn't know why, and I began to feel empathy for her and to think what it must be like to not be able to trust yourself when someone has asked you to do something and your memory doesn't remember that, and they are angry or they are hurt and you can't remember the conversation that you had, or when your boyfriend says, "But last night you promised me you'd call," and you have no memory of that at all. And at first, maybe you think that he's trying to pick a fight with you, or he's abusing you because he is telling you something that you do not remember, and you've always been confident in your own memory. And so I got a look at that world, and I began to experience it from an empathetic place. And then I realized I had to become able to tell her story. And I had to become able to understand what was going to happen when she had a baby. Would she remember what she needed to take care of that baby? She was burning food and it caused a little fire in her apartment because she couldn't keep track of what was on the stovetop. She'd turn the heat on and walk away and go into the other room and get engaged in a television program or something that she was reading. And lo and behold, her food was burning because her short-term memory wasn't working. These are classic stories that we see in our patients and our clients. The inability to get through an entire newspaper article without having to go back to the front page. And here she was planning a career in news. So Molly and I went down a long path together, and by the time we got towards the end of that path, which I'm happy to say was successful for her, I became dedicated to representing people with brain injuries. For me, and I hope for other people who do what I do, the law is not about making money. It's not about a job. It's a calling to help people. And that's what this is all about.
So neurologists often categorize brain injuries as mild, complicated, mild, moderate, or severe based on things like how alert the person is half an hour after the injury and how much amnesia they have after the injury, or were they knocked out, how long did that last, or complicated mild, where it would be classified as mild but something shows up on a brain scan, maybe a not very sensitive brain scan. So do you have a sense of what proportion of your cases fall into those categories?
I would say that about 30% of our cases are what we call them moderate to severe category. There is probably another 75% that are in the what you would call complicated mild, and then 5, maybe 10% that are in the mild TBI or traumatic brain injury category. Now those categories, as you know, are initial onset parameters. That is, medical professionals primarily coming out of the question of whether surgery needs to be performed or not, in a triage in a medical emergency room, having to do with, is this a mild injury in which there does not, at this point in time, require medical intervention? Is it a moderate injury in which there may have to be some type of medical intervention, or a severe injury in which surgery is likely and we need to move this person into the emergency surgery center? And so those classifications have lived on for many, many years now as to try to categorize what was the injury event and what happened in the immediate aftermath, whether they have lost consciousness for 30 minutes or less, or 30 minutes or more, all of those kinds of indicators. But those indicators of classification of mild, moderate to severe do not speak to what the long-term disability is going to be with respect to the individual and what they're going to experience. So, for instance, we'll often have a situation where someone goes to the emergency room and there's no loss of consciousness that has been reported to the ER doc, and they'll create a record. And yet we find that the patient, in sustaining the injury, actually did lose consciousness. Now, is that a uncomplicated mild traumatic brain injury?
I'm glad you raised that, because if the person themselves is not aware and there's no one else at the scene of the accident, there may be no one who can report accurately on whether someone has lost consciousness. What gets written down on an emergency room file when someone's brought in may or may not reflect accurately the loss of consciousness at the scene of the accident.
And if imaging does not initially indicate that there is a brain injury, such as, you know, when we have an MRI, MRIs basically are not sensitive enough to determine whether a brain injury is present or not. A CT scan, right? And a CT scan, certainly.
Even less so.
Even less so. So we have people that are let go from the hospital without a diagnosis. In over 80% of traumatic brain injuries, there is no diagnosis of a traumatic brain injury coming out of the emergency room. And that then gets used in litigation to say that no brain injury was incurred here, when in fact there's a substantial brain injury, but it doesn't meet the diagnostic criteria, because that's not the purpose of emergency medicine. The question is, can we do an intervention now that's going to make a difference? So, in our practice, once we learn the client's medical history, we want to make sure that they're actually getting the medical workup that's necessary to determine, is this a complex traumatic brain injury? Is this a moderate traumatic brain injury? And that may involve working with their doctors to see that there's functional brain imaging done. Also to make sure that instead of, I have great respect for family physicians, but oftentimes a family physician is confronted with a person suffering a brain injury, and they're frankly not qualified. By their own statement, they're not qualified to assess that.
They're not neurologists.
They're not neurologists. So we see that they get to a neurologist and that an appropriate neurologic examination is done. One of the interesting things is that, you know, if a neurologist can find positive findings in a general neurologic exam, then it is a complex mild traumatic brain injury, even without functional imaging of the brain itself. But generally speaking, when we find that there are positive findings in a neurologic exam, if we do functional brain injury imaging at that time, we will find evidence of actual structural changes in the brain or functioning of the structure of the brain.
Right. A decrease in blood flow or some area that's not active in the way that it would be in a typical brain.
Right.
And I want to underline what you said, that CT and MRI are very useful for emergency medicine, but they cannot be used to claim that there's no damage to brain tissue. They simply are not sensitive enough to be able to tell that. And in particular, white matter is something, as you know, that gets damaged in brain injury. And even an MRI, which has better resolution than a CT scan, is not going to show white matter injury.
Exactly so. And as you and I were talking earlier, the functional MRI is opening new worlds in order to look at not just the structure of the brain, but the functioning of the structures of the brain.
And so, which is what's going to impact daily life.
Right. One of the challenges for families of brain-injured individuals and, frankly, their legal counsel is to enable and authorize their medical team to get the imaging that's necessary to really establish whether there's been an injury here or not. We have to fight the insurance companies, health insurance companies, in order to get the type of imaging that has to be done. And a part of our practice is devoted to see that proper medical care actually takes place. We have to overcome those limitations on the financial willingness of the insurance companies to see that the appropriate testing is done.
I'm glad to hear that you do that, because my next question is going to be, and how is that functional imaging paid for? So now I know you work to make sure that there is a way that it can be.
Yeah, we have to work with the physicians, first of all, to make sure they're educated to know that that functional imaging exists, where it's available, how to get it authorized by a health insurance company. That may involve working with the health insurance company or even challenging the health insurance company's own assumptions about the efficacy of and the diagnostic use of those new imaging modalities. It takes a comprehensive effort to make sure that the family is being taken care of and the brain injured individual is taken care of, regardless of any considerations of litigation involved.
So are there particular kinds of cases involving brain injury that are more likely to settle without going to trial?
Yes, and that falls in a couple of different categories. I think that the cases that are most likely to settle are those where the insurance company that is defending the case and their attorney recognize that there is a brain injury and that they're willing to take responsibility and accountability for the damages that it's going to take to put the injured individual in the same place they would have been had they never been injured. Insurance companies have profiles identified of cases that they want to litigate. The most common example is where there is a low-speed impact in a motor vehicle case involving a car or a truck, so that they can raise the question as to whether is it possible that a person could have been hurt and sustained a brain injury in that crash. They then want to focus on the amount of damage to the car instead of the amount of damage to the person. And incredulously, they will look at the back bumper instead of the inside of the person's head to determine whether they sustained an injury. So they'll call in an accident reconstruction engineer to explain that there were very low forces and then raise the question for the jury, was there enough force involved in this crash to actually cause a brain injury? Well, you know, when you go to the emergency room or you go to see your doctor, they don't call an engineer to make a medical diagnosis.
They don't ask you to bring the rear bumper in with you.
That's right. They do not. And so it's an unscientific, invalid defense. But if you have lawyers who are prepared to challenge that on behalf of the brain-injured person, those insurance companies can get away with it, and those cases are likely to go to trial. Science and medicine have to be demonstrated in the courtroom and on the way to the courthouse to prevent families from having to go to trial in cases which should settle in their favor. On the other hand, you have to be prepared to present it at trial and to make sure that there's a good result. Another aspect of that, cases that won't go to trial, is when the insurance company does recognize that they're at substantial risk for losing the case and having to pay damages, and therefore they'll negotiate a reasonable settlement. And that settlement needs to really take care of all the life needs of that family. So if we look at it from the other way, what cases are likely to go to trial from the plaintiff's side, from the injured family's side? Those good cases where there is good evidence of injury and where that family and that brain-injured individual need to have members of the community come together to truly give the full measure of damages they're entitled to return them back to work, to return them to an ability to have their medical needs met in the future, and to provide them opportunities in the community that they would not have otherwise. For instance, someone who has a significant brain injury, they cannot work, they're having social problems, they need to have activities and access to those community activities that you and I would take for granted if we haven't had a brain injury. There are a myriad of opportunities for a significantly brain injured person to participate in the community, but unfortunately it costs money, which is only going to come through a lawsuit in too many cases. But yet it's worth going to trial, getting a sense of justice accomplished. I should say, rather, getting true justice accomplished for that family so that those funds are in place to take care of that person over their lifetime. You know, one of the great tragedies in a lot of brain injuries for individuals who are married is that the spouse of the brain-injured individual experiences a change in personality, and that the person they married is no longer the same person they fell in love with. And that doesn't mean that they don't continue to live with them and love them for the rest of their life, but there's a transition that has to occur. And at Mateer Law Firm, we work very hard at facilitating that transition that both the brain-injured person and their spouse is going to go through, seeing to it that there's counseling for the entire family as a result, that individually both the spouse and the injured individual are provided with psychological help as necessary to put their lives back together.
Well, I'm very glad to hear you talk about the social costs of brain injury, because as you know, that's something that's near and dear to my heart in brain injury cases, is that there are problems sometimes and changes in social behavior, and it's very important to address those in how the person is going to interact with the community and to rehabilitate those and to work with families on those as well.
Right. So we have to be able to identify what those resources are in each community in which a client or patient may live. In Colorado, in Wyoming, we have disparate opportunities depending upon what community that you live in. There are certainly centers like Craig Hospital, which are very good at follow-up for their patients. There are other hospitals and communities which are not nearly as well developed. And so part of what our role is to make sure that we identify what those resources are, and we make sure that those assessments and those resources are taken advantage of so that our clients can make the best recovery possible.
When a case does go to trial, are there particular kinds of cases that more easily gain a jury's sympathy, or are there other kinds of cases for which it's more difficult to gain the jury's sympathy?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the word sympathy. It's really, in a court of law, what we're interested in presenting is a case that brings up the empathy in jurors. And empathy, of course, is the ability to feel what the person who's injured feels, and for that matter, what the person who caused the injury feels, so that there's a shared humaneness, a shared human experience with the jury, so that they can have understanding as to what has occurred and what the consequences are. Sympathy is really just feeling sorry for somebody. And as a plaintiff's attorney, I can tell you, my clients don't want sympathy. They have all the sympathy they need. And frankly, they don't want anybody to feel sorry for them. They do, however, want to be able to have their story told as to what's happened to them and have a jury be able to experience empathy, to understand what it was from the jurors' own lives that matches with what has happened and what the experience is of the injured person. So I want to just change your question for a minute to what is it?
Okay. What elicits empathy or does not?
Well, here's the challenge in brain injury. We all know that our brain defines who we are. And so if our brain is injured, who we are is changed. Oftentimes, when a person sustains a brain injury, their personality changes. So one of the more challenging aspects of brain injury cases is to present the case of an individual whose personality is no longer as favorable as it was. In other words, they may now be a difficult person to have empathy with. And so those are some of the larger challenges. How do we cause a jury to understand that this person's personality has changed, and even now they may be a little prickly, kind of like a little porcupine. You want to love them, but it's hard to do. How do we present that case so that that person is treated fairly and that there is empathy for what's happening to them. One of the questions that we have is if this person's personality has changed, do they even know that their personality has changed? And I will address except in severe brain injury cases. The answer to that is yes, they do know they're a different person. And it's difficult for them to be the person who they are now. One of the other scientifically interesting but personally troubling aspects of brain injury is that the brain injury itself may cause a person not to recognize certain attitudes, habits, experiences that they're having, and they have blind spots. And so they may be less socially acceptable and socially engaging than they were before the injury. And being able to tell that story is a critically important part of representing brain injury clients, but it also takes a high degree of skill. It takes an understanding of what's physically happened to the brain and what the emotional changes are in that individual, and marry that with what their ability is to communicate. So that is both a challenging piece, but I can also, after having tried a lot of these cases and talked to a lot of jurors after those cases, that jurors really love to sit in these brain injury trials and learn about and take the parental role in understanding what's happened to this person, and therefore taking the responsibility of seeing to it that these deficits and the changes in this person's life are addressed in the verdict that they present at the end of the trial.
I'm glad to hear you say all that, because as a scientist, that's exactly what I studied in brain injury, is how the personality change and social problems that come up as a result of the brain injury, as a result of certain parts of the brain not functioning well, can sometimes make the person really very difficult to deal with. And I think that that can be an issue for attorneys in dealing with difficult clients.
It is. It can be very challenging, and that's why attorneys need to have knowledge about the very fact that their clients may be difficult because of the injury itself. I can tell you that on many occasions in our firm, someone will answer the phone with a potential new client, and they'll come back and say, you know, this person is not able to communicate well, and they seem to be hard to deal with, maybe angry, frustrated, short, not understanding what I seem to be trying to tell them over the phone. And, you know, what do we do? And I always say, well, please put them on the line with me. Let me talk to them. And we'll often find out that they're a person who's sustained a brain injury, and they may not even know that they've sustained a brain injury. They may be calling because they've had some orthopedic injury out of this accident. And we'll bring them in and really get to know them. And we have to then make the affirmative choice and recognize that what is making them a difficult person to deal with is in fact the brain injury itself and the very reason that they need our help. One of the other things, when we have new people to our firm, we have to train them to both really recognize and then know how to care for that person. For instance, if they've got an acquired brain injury, we may say, as we would with any other client, well, let's set an appointment for 10 a.m. Tuesday morning. But if they're a person with an acquired brain injury, they need to have special care. A call on Monday, perhaps, to remind them, and maybe two calls on Monday. And then maybe we need to arrange to send a car to pick them up so that they actually have someone who is able to get them to our office so they don't get lost on the way. Someone to make sure that information is being recorded for them during our interview, and so that that's put in writing for them by someone in our office so that they go home with a document that reminds them of what they need to do. Another example, and I've had this with a new receptionist who said, Mrs. Jones didn't come in for an appointment today. I said, well, did you send a car for Mrs. Jones? Did you remind her? You know, and that's on us if that happens, that Mrs. Jones isn't able to come because we didn't follow up. So for the attorneys out there who are thinking about getting involved in this work, you need to make plans for your office and your office staff and some training as to what to do. Another thing with a brain-injured client may be that because of short-term memory problems, if we get on the phone, often one of the first things I would do is say, well, if I'm talking to Julie Smith, the fictional name for purposes of our example, I might say, Julie, so good to talk with you today. Where are you in your house? Oh, you're in the kitchen. Well, reach into the drawer and get a paper and pencil. You got it? All right. Now let's talk about what we need to discuss. I know that you're going to go see your neuropsychologist next Tuesday. I want you to write down the date and time for me that you're going to call me at the conclusion of that interview with the doctor. Do you have a way of getting to the neuropsychologist's office? Do you need us to get a car for you? You do. Okay. Well, now I want you to write this down. We'll have the car at your front door at 9 a.m. And the driver's name will be Smith, Ed Smith. And he'll be at your door at 9 a.m. Okay. Now, I want you to put that under the refrigerator magnet there on the refrigerator so that you have that. So that you'll know when to call me back, that Mr. Smith's going to get you to the neuropsychologist's. And here's the question I want you to ask the neuropsychologist when you see him. Would you find out from the neuropsychologist when you and your husband can go to family orientation meeting on brain injury at his office so that we know that you are having that education and so that your spouse understands what to look for and how he can better help you through this situation? In other words, we know that we have people out there who cannot remember what it is that we're telling them or what they need to remember in order to help themselves. And that all has to be incorporated into a law practice that's going to serve a brain injured clientele.
Those are great recommendations, and I certainly hope that attorneys will implement them if they aren't already. There are a lot of excellent neurologists and neuropsychologists here in Colorado, and I'm sure you have particular ones that you work with, but I'm sure sometimes you're also dealing with whoever the client's treating psychologist is or treating doctor is. I guess I can ask this in either a positive or negative way. What are some of your frustrations in trying to read psychologist reports or doctor's reports? Or in a more positive way, can you tell us things that psychologists and doctors can do to make it easier to understand their reports about clients?
Sure. Let me say that we always work with the treating neurologists and neuropsychologists. And we're blessed in Colorado to have a lot of good practitioners. With Craig Hospital, with the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center, we do have an inordinate number of people who are well qualified to help our brain injured clients here. I think that my advice really is to attorneys to learn a lot about brain injury, about psychology and neuropsychology and neurology, the physiology of the brain, and what is involved in order to be able to interpret the records that are kept by the neurologists and neuropsychologists.
I'm going to jump in here and say I do have a jargon dictionary that's a PDF file that's available on my website for download. So if you need help going through those reports, that's available. And that my CLE courses are one way for you to learn that information.
Good, because here's the thing, is that for the most part, I would say 100% of the responsibility for being able to work with neurologists and neuropsychologists and other medical professionals, whether it's speech pathologists, occupational therapists, brain surgeons, they each have their own language, their own methods, and it's incumbent upon an attorney who's going to do traumatic brain injury work to be intimately familiar and to understand the science, the medicine, and the psychology. So it should not be a foreign language to a competent brain injury attorney specialist, any of those records. The one thing I would say to medical and psychological practitioners out there is to recognize that a promise of a good outcome in your records may or may not be appropriate in terms of how it's going to be interpreted in a litigation context. It's appropriate for you to put in those records whatever you need to, because those records are really for your own benefit. What I'm really thinking about are when you're writing letters to insurance companies to get authorization for treatment, sometimes there's an overstatement of expected outcome as a result of the treatment. That's necessary, oftentimes, to motivate a health insurance company to pay the bill for a very badly needed medical treatment or procedure. In the litigation context, that gets interpreted as a promise of a future good outcome, which in fact may not occur, just because even the best surgeon in the world working on a person who's injured, those injuries may, to some degree, prevent the super outcome that we hope for. So the brain injury litigation specialist or trial attorney needs to recognize that those statements sometimes have to be made, but they're not a promise of a great outcome.
Are there things that clinicians, psychologists or neurologists, can do to make themselves particularly effective at presenting evidence at a trial?
Yes, there is. And each of those, a medical professional or psychologist or neuropsychologist, they have to explain to their patients that they're treating, what the treatment's going to be, what the dangers and risks are going to be, what the benefits are going to be, and what they can experience in the coming time after the treatment or procedure is accomplished. When they're talking to a jury, they need to talk in that same educator's role, just as you would tell your patient and family members what can be expected. We need to talk at that level to a jury. As you know, Dr. Stone, when medical professionals or psychologists are talking to each other, they talk in a jargon. And that jargon is very informative to those who know, and it's very precise. But when we get in a courtroom, we need to get past the jargon. But let me make something clear. It's up to the trial attorney, up to the brain injury specialist, to be the translator and to make it easy for the psychologist, neuropsychologist, or a neurosurgeon to communicate with the jury. It's important that they understand, that is, the attorney understands the science and the medicine and is able to communicate with the jury and help the doctor communicate with the jury on that. So, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. The attorney needs to be competent and, in fact, skilled at that very function of being the interpreter of that information so that the jury understands what's going on. It's also incredibly important to be able to communicate with your client and the client's family members to help with that interpretation, because I can't tell you how often one of our clients with an acquired brain injury comes into our office not understanding what their doctor has told them. We have to be able to provide that interpretation to them because it makes them scared not to know what their doctor thinks. It makes them scared not to know what that procedure outcome is going to be. It makes them very fearful and sometimes even distrusting of their physician, because they don't feel like they know what the physician thinks, and they don't know if the physician trusts them or believes they're really injured, when in fact that practitioner does have faith in the patient and is doing the best for them, but their brain injury is getting in the way of understanding. So if I had any advice for young attorneys thinking about getting involved in traumatic brain injury, it is to work on your communication skills, study psychology, understand the medicine, and understand the important role that you have in the life of your brain-injured client, which is completely separate from your role as an attorney in a courtroom or in litigation. You have a real effect on these people's lives. You're a central part of their support system. They're going to depend upon you. And because of the importance of a favorable outcome in getting compensation so they can get their lives put back together, you can't treat them as anything other than family members of your own. You have to deal with them on that level.
Good advice. Can you tell us a little about some mistakes you might have made in brain injury cases early in your career as you were learning about this stuff?
Yes. I guess confession's good for the soul. Let me talk about that. First of all, I worry that as a young attorney, I didn't recognize clients who had sustained a brain injury. They may have come in with their orthopedic injuries from a car accident, and I treated it, I'm afraid, as just an orthopedic case, because the subtleties of recognizing brain injury take some study and the energy to follow up. And as attorneys, we're not taught to recognize brain injury, just as the rest of us aren't, unless we're a medical or a psychological professional. Then, once recognizing that there is a brain injury, not initially knowing enough about the medicine and the psychology involved in order to help this person. I can't tell you how important it is that attorneys get medical and psychological education if you're going to be doing traumatic brain injury work. And for those of you who are family members or brain injury individuals yourself, it's important that you find out when you're selecting an attorney, do they have that educational background and what is their experience? I think that one of the things that's very important for any young attorney is to associate with an experienced attorney if you're going to take one of these cases, so that you get some guidance. Medical professionals, after 4 years of medical school, get the right to be called a doctor, but yet they have to do a residency and internships and clinical practicums. It is incumbent upon lawyers to mentor other lawyers in this area, and it's important for lawyers who are starting out to seek mentorship, and the way that you do that is you work these cases up together.
So in personal injury cases, defense attorneys obviously have certain tactics that they use to win a case for their clients, maybe trying to establish that the injury wasn't as severe as claimed, or that certain difficulties a plaintiff is having are not caused by the injury. So do you have any advice for other attorneys on strategies to respond to those tactics?
Absolutely. One of the primary tactics is to get to the truth of the matter yourself. Understand what happened in this event that caused the injury. Understand how, from a medical and an anatomical and physiological standpoint, this injury was caused. Get yourself to the place where you can teach that to a group of eighth graders so that they can understand how this crash or this event that caused this injury actually resulted in injury to the brain. How do you talk about it? How do you demonstrate it? What do you have to do so that any person with an eighth grade education or maturity level even, and I would suggest you actually get a group of junior high students into your office and tell them the story until they can understand exactly how it works and why it's true. And then tell them the defense story so that they can understand that the defense is not telling the truth. One of the things that is very common in brain injury cases is the reliance upon scientific literature. Literature from medical sources, from brain science sources, from neuropsychological sources. A lot of that literature will disagree with each other on its face. So really understanding, is it a valid study? Is there scientific evidence that supports the opinions that the defense is trying to sell? We talked earlier about trying to look at the damage to a car and predict whether a person suffered an injury in the crash, particularly a brain injury in the crash. They are completely logically unrelated to each other. You can have brain injury from a car with no damage, and you can have extreme damage to a car and have no brain injury at all. So really understanding what the scientific basis of what the defense is trying to say is a place to start. The other thing that's incredibly important is you need to have the trial skills to be able to take the truth and the science and present it to a jury in such a way that they can understand it and realize that there is not another side of the story that reduces those damages or casts doubt upon whether this person was injured. I believe that the trial work in a brain injury case is the most complicated on the face of the earth. I think it's more challenging than a death penalty case. I think it's more challenging than any other law or case that an attorney can be called to present in a court of law. And the reason is that it's about an entire person. If we're talking about whether somebody had a broken leg or not, why, we can look at an x-ray and we can determine whether there was a limp that they have for the rest of their life and how that may affect their ability to make a living. But those are things that in everyday life, each of us has some experience or some way of relating to. When we talk about a brain injury, it isn't just whether the brain injury occurred, but how did that brain injury affect this person's intellectual and emotional functioning? How does it affect all aspects of their life, whether it's family relationships, work relationships, self-confidence, depression, joy, sexual drive? All of those things that make us human are all affected, and the advocate who steps before a judge and a jury to present that case needs to have the experience and the skill to have us all have those experiences together in a way that will create empathy, that is, understanding from our own life experiences as to what the changes are in this individual. That's not simple. So if you're going to undertake this type of work, it has to become a mission.
Getting organized to bring a personal injury lawsuit is obviously very complex. people with brain injuries, because of the fact that they have a brain injury, have difficulty with exactly the kinds of complex organizational skills that are needed to bring a lawsuit or, in fact, to do really any complex task. So I can imagine that it would seem very overwhelming and daunting. What does your firm do to help clients in working their way through preparing such a case?
Well, in our firm, we've recognized a long time ago that for the brain-injured individual and their family, there are these extreme challenges in just getting through their life. They need to be able to put the responsibility and their trust in a group of lawyers and other professionals that work at our firm in order to take them forward into the future so that they have what they need in order to survive and thrive, and also that we can guide them through, as you said, what is a very complex system of putting their case together and presenting their case, representing them with the insurance companies, seeing if we can get an advantageous settlement for them, and if not, to present their case at trial and do it powerfully. First of all, in a complex case such as brain injury, it takes a team of professionals in order to do that. We have teams, and we take a team approach within our firm. We do training so that we're sensitive to the needs of brain-injured individuals. We're also sensitive to the needs of other catastrophically injured clients. And sometimes, of course, there are other injuries that are catastrophic in addition to a brain injury, such as spinal cord compromises where there's paralysis involved, other complex issues. We provide a support system for our brain-injured clients that I would like to think is second to none. As we talked about, we will arrange for our brain-injured clients to make sure that there's a memory system in place for them, that they get to their appointments, that we assist them with daily living activities and assessments. We'll arrange for occupational therapists to come to their homes to do assessments to make sure that they have the physical needs are being met, that there's a system for communication in place, for memory assistance in place, transportation in place, modifications to the home as may be necessary. Our staff is trained to be sensitive to their needs so that there are follow-ups that are done on a regular basis with them to make sure they're okay.
And like you were talking about earlier, making sure they're here for appointments and giving reminders and...
Absolutely. We also have to do a review to make sure that they're getting the medical care that they need. It is so easy to drop through the cracks. After all, a physician may see you initially for an hour and then in 15-minute appointments thereafter. They're not aware of what's going on in your home life or what the challenges are for transportation. Are you getting to see other appointments that are required? We work with life care planners. We work with having nurses that are employed to make sure that they get to appointments, and in fact we call them nurse case managers, to make sure that there's a coordination among the doctors as to what treatment is, what the results of examinations are. If you think about it, a person with memory problems, being our brain-injured client, goes to see a doctor, gets instructions for follow-up that they cannot remember. So we may have a nurse case manager attend that appointment and carry that information to see that follow-up appointments are made. If there's a referral, if they're to another physician, to make sure that that is followed through and that the information from the first physician is given to the second physician. What about prescriptions? What about physical therapy appointments? All that has to be coordinated on an active basis. We also work with a psychologist. We work with the psychologist that is treating the patient and our client, but we also have a psychologist that we work with within our firm to make sure that the needs are being met for the client. And when it comes to preparing family members or our client for testimony, whether it's deposition or at trial or hearing of some kind, we'll use the services of a psychologist to make sure that there's a healthy approach and a complete approach to preparing them for testimony. One of the things that we have to be careful of, and particularly to family members and attorneys who may be listening to this, if oftentimes there's post-traumatic stress disorder or other anxiety disorders that accompany as a symptom of the traumatic brain injury itself, or were acquired in the event that caused the injury. This is not amateur hour to be working with clients who may have those conditions. And so we both have to have training within our firm, and we do, as to how to work appropriately with those individuals that may have those conditions. Part of that is to have a psychologist really on call to help address those situations as part of our team. Other ways that it's important to understand from the attorney's perspective and from the injured person's perspective is that it takes a team of lawyers having different roles in terms of preparing their case. In our firm, we have at least two attorneys assigned to every case, sometimes more. We'll have an attorney who's in charge of just getting the discovery done and then dealing on a daily basis to see that the litigation in the court and in discovery among the parties is accomplished. But we've also got to have a trial specialist involved, someone to look at the larger picture, someone to prepare for the trial. And again, in brain injury, and I believe in any serious injury case, there's actually more time and more attorney hours involved in preparing the case for trial than there is in the entire discovery process. And yet most attorneys think the discovery process is where all their efforts should go. And so at our law firm, we have an attorney that certainly is involved in that discovery process and in fact is almost exclusively focused on it, so that our trial specialist will be focused on trial and putting all of that together, in addition to all we've talked about in terms of making sure the client is receiving good care and that those aspects of both physical and psychological health are being attended to during this process. And it is certainly true that the litigation process can be stressful for the parties involved. And so that needs to be recognized and incorporated in the plans and in your representation.
Now, obviously, most people who bring a lawsuit have never been involved with a lawsuit before. And some people find the prospect of suing an insurance company kind of scary. They're not sure how much it might cost them or how difficult it might be. So what would you say to reassure people who are thinking about starting a personal injury lawsuit? And what would you encourage other plaintiffs' attorneys to say to reassure potential clients?
Well, first of all, if I'm a potential client, someone who sustained an injury or a family member of one, and I'm going to find an attorney, I'd want to know, particularly in the brain injury arena, that I'm working with a lawyer who has been there, who understands these issues we've been discussing, and that has the skills to present a brain injury case. If I'm an attorney looking at these cases, I want to understand that there is a substantial commitment of time to properly represent a brain injured individual. And it's not just the time in litigation or in meetings with the clients. It's to understand that there has to be original research done on the science and on the health issues and on the neuropsychological issues in every case. They're all unique. That it's going to take extraordinary time with the clients that has to be spent. We need to go to their homes. We need to understand how they live on a day-to-day basis. We have to understand what their social sphere consisted of before the crash and after the crash. That's before the injury or after the injury. That we have to be able to understand how they're perceiving the world now and recognize whether there are problems with depression, whether there are problems with anxiety, whether the health care professionals involved are getting the authorizations they need to provide additional care and get paid for it by health insurance or other sources. There's a whole myriad of activity that is in addition to what you were taught in law school. So to really undertake these kinds of cases, it takes a dedication and a recognition on the front end that you're making a commitment to a family or to an individual here, and that their world has changed and that you're willing to make that commitment to do everything that you can to make it right. So if you don't have that time, then I would suggest you find a law firm to co-counsel with and to help you learn about this. If this is a situation in which it's not an area of the law that you want to pursue over a number of years to get the expertise, then be sure you refer the case to a law firm that has those competencies. For family members, I think it's important that you develop a relationship with the attorneys, not just have your loved one have that relationship, because this is about you as well as the person who was hurt. We all know, at least we should be informed, that if a husband or wife are hurt, the spouse has a right to their own claim. And in brain injury cases, there are extraordinary changes in the life of the spouse. And those should be claimed and addressed and represented throughout this entire matter. I so often see that spouses of brain injured individuals may not even be able to maintain their own jobs because they've got to take care of the family and of the brain injured individual. That it changes the spouse's social interactions, who they get to spend time with, what their schedules are. All of these things, which are significant life changes, let alone the changes in the relationship between the spouse and the brain injured individual. So the children are affected, mothers and fathers are affected, the social community is affected. And you have a right as a brain injured person or a family member of a brain injured person to know the attorney, to understand what the ramifications are both socially and legally and medically, and that lawyer is an important player in that as a central clearinghouse and also as the person who's going to tell your story. In thinking about bringing a lawsuit, not only is there the fear, as you've said, of having to deal with insurance companies, but in this particular type of injury, as well as any significant injury case, you need to know that your attorneys are going to take care of you, stay in communication with you, and guide you through all of this so that there's as little stress and as little disruption in your life as possible.